Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
I bumbled last week.
And you said coach?
I did. I said coach a couple times. I miss Coach Kelly. Oops, it's Therapist Kelly.
It's fine.
You're changing your identity. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't recognize you
anymore.
I feel
like Caitlyn Jenner. Like, you know, it's almost to that. No, either way is fine. It's okay.
Yes, but many of our listeners will still think of you fondly as Coach Kelly. And you are still a great coach.
Oh,
but I love that you are, getting your hours for licensing. So it's very exciting.
Exactly.
Oh my God, I haven't seen you in 2 weeks.
It's
do
crazy.
Tell. How
oh
are you?
Oh my God. Okay, so I went back to the East Coast. I saw my parents. It was a great week. The plane ride.
Oh God.
We could have done without. Remy was fine. He had his iPad. He's totally content. He could literally be on that thing for 24 hours straight.
Really?
London, my younger son who's 3. Let's just say I bought drinks for every single person sitting around me.
Oh, no, you
yes,
did?
Yes.
Alcoholic drinks?
Alcoholic drinks for every person around me because he was just kicking the seats and he didn't want to be there and he was he's just, I don't know. It's like, you know, some kids are totally content, like on the, like in a little space. He just wants to get out. And it was intense. And
he's
then
a little monkey.
Oh, my God. Oh, I love you. Have compassion. I should have had you on that flight. The flight attendant came over. She's like, can I help you? Do you want any cookies for him? I'm like, sure, I'll take whatever. Anything to stop the screaming. So,
well, now, how does he respond to, like, new people? I've only met him a couple of times,
yeah,
when really actually interacted with him, but with strangers and stuff. Because if I had been on the plane with
yes,
you and I didn't know you, I'd say, give your kid to me. I'll hang out with
yeah,
them for a little
oh
while.
God,
since I love kids.
I know, you're so adorable.
And sometimes they really love new and different
yes,
energy.
Completely. Typically, he does. If he's already at that level 10, forget it. Like, you
too
could
much
be Elmo and he's not going to calm down, you know? Yeah. He's, you know, there's no going back.
Oh.
So that was rough. But other than that, it was a great trip. And then I was also really happy to come back to LA. Like, I feel more settled than I did before. Like, I missed it. It was nice.
Oh, nice. But you also, you had a little quick trip to Washington, D.C., right?
Exactly.
Because your parents then were able to watch the Rascals.
Exactly. We had one night out. It was fantastic. I did a spinning class. We saw a movie.
You don't spin enough at home with your
legs. Sometimes you're right. My head spins,
yes,
not my legs. But no, it was great. And it was just cool. We explored Georgetown. We walked around and it was like perfect. It was right in the middle of the week. So it was like a good, you know, downtime.
I just love Georgetown. That's
really cool.
It's such a happening place.
Yeah.
It was really cool.
Neat. Yeah.
Oh, neat.
What about you?
Well, it feels like a whirlwind of activity. My daughter came in, Tiffany, about a week ago Sunday.
Okay.
And she brought her dog and, you know, the cats and the dog, no.
That's right.
So Missy, she only dug one hole this time. She didn't dig up the whole yard. She stayed in the side yard. She was great. Actually, she's mellowed out. Tiffany found some herbal flower thing or something that she uses with her to reduce her separation anxiety.
That's great.
And seemed to work well.
Fantastic.
Then her boyfriend, who I had never actually met, came into town on Wednesday, and he stayed with us also, and we love him. And he brought his dog, Ginger. So Ginger and Missy could play a little bit on the side yard. And her boyfriend, Michael, is just, he's a gem.
Oh.
He's an absolute keeper. If she doesn't keep him, I will.
Exactly.
I mean,
you're like, come on, come to me. That's so great.
You know, and as a mom of a daughter, you know, you just, it's unsettling if she's with somebody who you don't necessarily think is good
for
her.
Yep.
You know, but this guy, just A+.
Oh,
just adore
so
him.
So nice.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So my daughter, I have to tell you this because I'm just so touched by the things that she did. She made this basket for me for my gift.
Okay.
That was filled with so much love and so much kindness and thought that I just couldn't help but just cry. I mean, it was just amazing. She had this box, this really beautiful box, and inside the box were all these folded up pieces of paper of affirmations on which she drew little pictures on them. So my affirmation for today is, I am remaining in a state of conscious awareness, mindful and fully connected with my breath.
I love Tiffany. Like, do you understand that, like, this is, like, my, I, like, love her and I haven't met her and I feel like we're the same person.
I know.
This is so sweet.
So sweet. So every day I have to go into the box. Not have to. I can't wait to go into the box and I get to pick one. I carry it around with me and I'm going to share it with my clients because I think it's just really
so
sweet.
Sweet.
Yeah.
So I love it. Awesome. So creative. Very cool.
Well, we could catch up forever, but we have a really amazing show today. Yes. Let's give our listeners a recap in case they missed last week's show. I had on my friend Jack Saul, who is an MFT, as a co-host for Kelly Wasn't Here. So Jack was, he was good, you know? He wasn't you, but he was good. Yeah.
So cute.
And we had fun because he and I have been friends for well over 25 years. We had a great guest. She wrote the book, My Fat Dad, and she was really...
So cool, interesting. So can you give us a rundown about the book, what it was about?
Yeah, basically, I mean, she literally grew up with a mom who basically had no interest in food, whether you'd call her anorexic or not, as we didn't really get too deep into that. And dad who was 450 pounds, and he was like the madman era and, you know, really into the Hollywood and the studios and did all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of like her story of having had this really nurturing grandmother who she called Beauty and who would always send her recipes once her parents moved away from where the grandma lived. She would send this young woman recipes and recipe cards so that she could make food and nourish herself because her parents or dad was always on a diet, always on like the Pritikin and all that stuff. So it's really an interesting story. So if anybody missed that, check out that book, My Fat Dad, and there you go.
Yeah. Very cool. So I'm super excited.
I know. I know. You found our guest for today.
Okay.
All right.
So I have always been sort of a worrier, and I just adore the book, The Worry Cure. So I reached out to the author. His name is Dr. Robert Leahy, and he is the nicest gentleman so far. I mean, even just in our interactions, I can tell he's just a really, really sweet, sweet guy. And so I'm going to give a little bio for him. So Dr. Robert Leahy is the past president of the Association for Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies, past president of the International Association of Cognitive Psychotherapy, past president of the Academy of Cognitive Therapy, director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy in New York, and the clinical professor of psychology and psychiatry at Weill Cornell University Medical School. Dr. Leahy is the honorary lifetime president, New York City Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Association, and a distinguished founding fellow diplomat of the Academy of Cognitive Therapy. He has received the Aaron T. Beck Award for Outstanding Contributions in Cognitive Therapy. He serves on a number of scientific committees for international conferences on cognitive behavioral therapy and is a frequent keynote speaker and workshop leader at conferences and universities throughout the world. He's the author and editor of 23 books, including the one we'll feature today, The Worry Cure, which received critical praise from New York Times and has been selected by Self Magazine as one of the top 8 self-help books of all time.
Of course, he's been on the big shows like Good Morning America, The Early Show. What a guy. Welcome. Hello.
Are you there, Dr. Leahy?
I am. My God, it's exhausting just listening to my bio.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
And by the way, that was the condensed version.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh. It was like literally I had to pick and choose. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Okay. Great. I hope I can live up to that.
Yes. Oh, you can. You already do. Just in the tone of your voice and your great laugh. So welcome to our show. We're so happy to have you here. So I know.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Tell us what inspired you to write this book.
Well, we were in my wife and I were in Istanbul, Turkey on 9/11/2001.
Oh.
And when we got back to New York, everybody was worried, including all the therapists on my staff. And so I thought, you know, I could either sit around and worry or I could write a book on worry. So I actually was motivated by the fact that there was a tremendous increase of worry about future terrorist attacks in New York, I'm sure elsewhere. But also just the fact that, you know, there's so many people worry. And it's something that a lot of people say, I've been a worrier all my life. You know, we know from research that 38% of people say, oh, I worry every day. And when you look at people who are in their 70s who have generalized anxiety disorder, who worry a lot, that the average length of time that they've been chronic worriers is about 35 years. So it tends to be a persistent and very difficult problem for people to cope with. And hopefully the book The Worry Cure and some of the things that we'll talk about today can give people some direction.
Yes, for sure.
Interesting. How do you differentiate, or do you differentiate between worry and anxiety, or are they one and the same?
It's an excellent point. I mean, they're often treated as if they're the same, but I view worry as a thinking pattern that you have, where you have recurring negative thoughts about the future, like I'll miss my plane, or my talk will go poorly, or I'll be rejected. Those are all thoughts that the person has. Whereas anxiety, I think we can think about it as arousal, like I'm sweating, I'm tense, I can't sleep, that kind of thing.
More the physical.
Interesting. One thing that's interesting, Deborah, is that when people are worried, when they're thinking, their physical arousal is temporarily decreased, which is counterintuitive. People wouldn't think that. You would think, oh, I'm worried and I'm anxious. But what happens is that when you worry, your physical arousal is actually decreased temporarily. So worry, actually, it's kind of something that you're doing in the thinking part of the brain, and you're suppressing the emotional part of the brain temporarily. That physical arousal, the anxiety, then comes back later. It seems to come out of nowhere. I mean, we used to call it free-floating anxiety, where people would just like, gee, I'm just tense all the time, I can't sleep. But that's the interesting thing about the relationship between the emotional arousal or anxiety and the cognitive or thinking part of worry.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
And I would think, though, in the long term, though, there is a negative feedback loop, right? That the more somebody worries, then it can lead to anxiety, and then the anxiety leads to more worries about the things they were anxious about.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a vicious cycle that, and as I said, it continues on for some people for years, even decades. So it's a very widespread problem. A lot of people who have generalized anxiety, which is a chronic worry type thing, often are not able to get the kind of help that they need. You know, they get reassurance, like, you know, don't worry, try to think positively.
Yeah.
You know, believe in yourself. None of that works.
Isn't that the worst thing you could ever say to somebody?
That.
Don't worry when they're worried about something,
or like relax when you're tense.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Right. People would say to me, right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Like it's not a big deal.
Right.
Why are you making such a big deal? What's a big deal to me right now?
Exactly. And you're making it worse. Yeah. I'm dying to know, because I always wanted to know this. I was always the type of person who did, like, the extra credit in school. And, like, I had that, like, anticipatory anxiety. Like, I didn't want to think about the project, so I would get it done, like, 2 weeks before. And I never, like, I was always envious of the people who were just like, oh, yeah, I'll do it, you know,
whenever.
The day before.
Right. Right.
And so I'm wondering, is that just, like, a temperament? Are just people more, you know, relaxed? Or is it that, like, warriors are more motivated? Or can you explain any of that?
Well, there's a style of worry that's known as defensive pessimism, and it sounds like you may be a good candidate for that category. That it's character. These are people who tend to be perfectionistic and want to do extremely well, and they believe that if they worry, if they scare themselves, they'll be highly motivated. And in fact, in some cases, it works.
Yes.
So it may be in your case, you got very highly motivated because you were afraid you were not going to do well, and you prepared very well, and then you did very well.
Yeah.
So sometimes defensive pessimism works. But for a lot of people, worry, you know, interferes with concentration, interferes with memory. You can't really focus. You lose sleep. Your mind gets distracted. It's like filling your mind with a lot of extraneous distracting thoughts when you're taking a test. So worry can actually interfere with performance when you actually get right down to it. I think that there's a difference. What I describe in the book is a difference between productive worry and unproductive worry. Like, you know, productive worry would be worry that leads me to take action today to solve the problem. So let's say that productive worry is I'm going to the Virgin Islands in a couple of weeks. Productive worry, do I have my hotel reservation? That could be productive in that I can check it. There's a to-do list today. I can do something today to solve that problem. I can see if I have a hotel reservation. Unproductive worry might be, what if I get attacked by a shark when I'm snorkeling? Nothing I can do about it. I understand that sharks can go anywhere they want to go.
Right,
so
right.
It's a lot of the worry that people do is unproductive. But making that distinction, I think, is important. It's like the first thing you can ask yourself is, what I'm worrying about, is this actually going to lead to productive action to solve the problem today? You know, to make sure that I'm on the phone with you at 1 o'clock your time.
Right.
That would be productive to make sure that that happens. Unproductive would be, you know, what do people think of me, or will my mind go blank? There's nothing I can do about that.
Yeah.
So that leads us to the second step in dealing with worry, which is to accept certain things, like accepting uncertainty, mm-hmm. accepting I can't control things, that kind of thing. And, you know, as you know, we were talking about mindfulness just a moment ago. You know, we accept things all the time. We mm-hmm. accept the traffic. We accept the weather. We accept that we don't know things for sure. But a lot of people who worry have a hard time with accepting uncertainty, lack of control, imperfection, those sorts of things. So a lot of what we have to do to think about worry is to build up as much acceptance as possible.
That's so true. Boy, I work with so many people with anxiety and depression, and you just listen to the pain they have in their minds and in their bodies about all these things that they don't have control over. It's just mm-hmm. so challenging to get somebody to just pause and say, you don't have control over that, and that's okay. Like telling a perfectionist that they don't have control over something is so aggravating and so frightening. One of the things that I grapple with, and let me know if this comes up for you too, is how people often think that the only way things will be okay is if you can promise them safety, but you can never really promise somebody that they will be safe in a minute from now or mm-hmm. in 10 seconds from now. You can just promise that at this moment. If you look at what is, what is that nothing bad is happening at this moment.
Yeah.
Do you have some tools for that?
Well, first of all, what we know, just to kind of put it in perspective, we know when we follow people who worry over the course of a year, 85% of the things people worry about don't happen or have a positive outcome.
Oh, so I like that. So
we're predicting all of these things that don't happen. And then we know that 79% of the people where something happened that was negative, they actually say, gee, I handled it much better than I thought I would. So, you know, there are a lot of things that are unforeseen. There are a lot of traffic jams or impediments or, you know, mistakes that happen or, you know, setbacks that happen. But worriers are actually good at solving real problems, but they're not really good at solving problems that don't exist yet. Like if I said to you, what I want you to do is to figure out how to solve a problem on April 4th that I can't even tell you what it is, and I want you to do it now, you would think I was psychotic. But that's what the worrier tries to do. They try to solve imaginary problems. You can't do that.
Yes.
I think the other thing is that worriers often think that if something negative happens, it's going to have a persistent negative effect. So, for example, you look at research on resilience, mm-hmm. that when people look, you know, they say, oh, if this negative event happened, oh, my God, I'd be upset for the rest of my life. So they actually follow people like a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years after a divorce. You know, 85% of people after the divorce are as happy as they were before they got the divorce. Some are actually happier. That, you know, you have people who actually lose a limb.
Dr. Lauber, hang on one quick second. We got a phone call.
Just hold on.
Hi, you're on air live with Dr. Deborah and therapist Kelly.
Hi.
Are you calling the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly show?
Yes. What is about?
Oh, did you have a question for us? We're talking about worry today.
Okay.
Worry. Okay.
Did you have a question for us?
No. I would like to listen to you guys.
Okay.
Can you listen on your telephone or on your computer?
I'm all the way from Colombia. I don't know where you guys where to hear you guys?
If you go to latalkradio.com, you can. There's a button that says "Listen Live," and you can listen there.
LA Talk.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for listening.
I'm sorry about that, Dr. Leahy. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay,
good. We always encourage callers, so we like it when they call, but we thought he may have a question, but he didn't. Okay, so continue on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so we know from the research on resilience that people are actually quite good at recovering from negative life events like divorce or the death of a partner or losing a job or other kinds of things that happen. So worriers tend to underestimate their ability to recover from things. I mean, one way of thinking about it, if I said, well, here's a foot wide board and I'm going to put it on the 10th floor to the building across the street on the 10th floor and I want you to walk across it, you would say I would never do that because if I fall, I'll definitely get killed. But if I said I'll put it like 5 inches off the floor, you would say, fine, I can do that. Mm-hmm. But the worriers are often thinking that if they fall, something happens, it's going to be catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one way of thinking about it is, you know, if you ask yourself, what did you worry about 5 years ago? You know, and a lot of times people say, I'm worried about this thing, and, well, it happened, and I got over it. Or it didn't happen. Either way, you're still here. And a lot of times we tend to think that if we imagine something bad happening, that it's going to happen. Like you take the fear of terrorism right now that's so prevalent. I'm sure you have a lot of it in California now because of San Bernardino.
Sure.
You know, there were 37 people in the United States who got killed by terrorism in 2015. But there were 600,000 people who died from cancer. There are more people who are likely to die from the effects of eating McDonald's cheeseburgers and Cokes than from being killed by a terrorist. You know, there are 325 million people in the United States. 2.9 million people die every year. So what we have to do is we have to think about, yeah, it's scary when you see those images, but what is the actual probability that an individual person is going to be killed?
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to overestimate it all the time. Mm-hmm. If you look at the response that people had after San Bernardino, how horrible it was that anybody was killed, but the idea that everybody is at a high risk is just simply not true. People can say that, well, I could be the one, but that's always the case. You can be the one who has a brain hemorrhage. You could be the one who you know falls and slips on ice in New England and dies. But you don't worry about those sorts of things because they're very low probability. You're more likely to be killed drowning in your bathtub than by being killed by terrorism.
Wow.
Yeah.
So interesting.
It's good perspective.
I think
it helps people to understand statistics when you put it out there like that. So those are really helpful for our listeners. Thank you so much. Hey, and by the way, you are listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, our new name, and I love our new name because it's us.
Yes.
And if you do have a phone call for Dr. Leahy, it's area code 323-203-0815. What I meant to say is if you have a question for the doctor or for us, feel free to call. We'd be happy to take your questions. Yeah, this is all fascinating
stuff.
I
love this.
I tended in my, some would have maybe called me a bit of a drama queen, but I do have a little bit of catastrophic thinking. Which is why I wrote the book, Don't Call Me a Drama Queen.
It's great.
But, so bless my daughter's heart when I was in the kitchen one time and I was freaking out about something, not like serious freak out, but just like really spinning my head in a way that I just didn't need to. And she looks at me, she goes, Mom, is that really going to bother you in 5 minutes from now? And I said, probably not. She was like, well, then just chill now.
Wow.
I know, she's such a wise little soul.
It's so smart. Well, when you had said that, Dr. Leahy, about, you know, think about what you worried 5 years ago. I mean, it's so interesting because when you had said that, I had my first child and I was trying to get pregnant with my second and I had some problems and I couldn't and we were seeing fertility doctors and that was just so on my mind. Are we going to have this second child? And here I am. I'm talking talking about how he was, you know, kicking somebody's seat on the plane. He's three now. And, you know, and so it's like, it is so interesting that you know, that problem becomes such a big deal, you know, at that time. And then when you look back, you're like, oh, everything was fine. It all worked out, you know, the way it was supposed to. So I really like that.
Yeah. And if things don't work out the way they're supposed to, you adjust the way things are. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I think I'm not saying that we should just think positively, because I don't think that's realistic. But if you think, well, maybe I'd be pretty good at handling problems that come along, we'll have to see. If you think about how you've handled problems in the past, problems that actually occur, you might find, well, you know, in some cases I wasn't so good because I ruminated a lot or I avoided, but in some cases I actually took the problem on, I tried to solve it, mm-hmm. I accepted less than perfection, and I got on with my life. So, you know, worriers treat their thoughts as if they're true predictions of reality. And they think that if I have a thought that I could really screw up badly, they think they have to neutralize their thought. They have to get rid of that thought. They have to answer that thought. They have to prove the thought is wrong. So one of the techniques I've developed is what I call the boredom technique, which I think actually is kind of an interesting technique. And the boredom technique is to take your worry, like you say, your worry, oh, my mind will go blank and I'll screw up, and just repeat that like about 500 times slowly, like a zombie. What you'll find is that for the first couple of minutes, your anxiety will go up. Oh my God, I might screw up and my mind will go blank. But after a few minutes, you get really, really bored with the negative thought. So this boredom technique is kind of like flooding you with the negative thing. The more you flood yourself with the negative thing, really slowly, monotonously, over and over, the more bored you become. And boredom is a great antidote to feeling anxious about something.
I love that.
So
that's like
interesting.
Another version of desensitizing to something. So that's awesome.
Exactly. That's right. All right.
But well, no one wants to be...
If I make a comment, I think both of you are animal people. Am I correct?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Deborah, you have a picture of the cat? Yeah?
Yes.
All right. So cats, I think both of you have a cat, and probably a lot of your listeners have cats. I think cats are great at not worrying. And the reason is that cats only have four thoughts. Check this out. This feels good. This doesn't feel good. I want that. And what's next?
I love that.
That's so true.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't feel good, they just walk away.
Exactly.
I'll go find what feels good.
That's right.
Well, it's
or what's next?
What's
right?
next?
Whereas dogs, on the other hand, man's best friend, are just as neurotic as, man, are you angry at me? Did I do something wrong? Will you ever come back? Will I ever get fed again?
Right, exactly.
So, dogs are extremely anxious and extremely advanced. Whereas cats have been around for 23 million years and have not really evolved. I mean, they basically are the same cat 23 million years ago, because how would you improve on a cat? So there they have it. You know, this feels good. This doesn't feel good. I want that. And what's next?
It's so funny.
The life of a cat. I envy my cats. Yeah, I'm the cat person. And Kelly is more the dog person. Although I love dogs, I can't have them with the cats. Although I keep threatening the cats, I'm bringing home that Pomeranian really soon. They look at me and they say, "We'll just eat it, Mom."
No, but I love animals because I agree with you. I think there is, I mean, even though dogs may be more anxious, I think there is that reminder that they really are much more present than humans. You know, they're just, I mean, I remember once I had a meditation group over and we all kind of watched my dog for a little bit because he just was kind of in the moment. It was like, all right, this pillow looks good. You know, okay, my paw, you know, this itches. Like, they're just very present. It's really nice.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Now, actually, when you pet a dog, the oxytocin in your brain is activated, which calms down. You know, it's kind of like getting a little heroin or something.
Yes.
And the same thing happens in the dog. So the both of you are like oxytocin. you know, you don't need heroin if you have a dog.
Yes.
No.
So true.
Or a cat. I've got one of my cats actually comes over to my guy at night, Christopher, and gets a massage. He literally comes somewhere between 9 o'clock and 9:30 on the couch. He plops down in the same position.
No way.
On belly exposed. Yeah. And it's like, all right, I'm here. It's my appointment.
This is so
bring it on. Yeah. And he gets so mad. If it's not coming at the time that expects, he headbutts. He'll go all around the couch and he'll just knock him in the head. He'll use his head. He'll push on his arm. He'll push on his hands. Like, give me what I want right now.
Funny.
So, it's all about the priorities.
Yeah, exactly.
So cute. So I have to ask you a personal question. have you ever suffered from anxiety yourself?
It's funny. I remember when I was first learning cognitive therapy, I went through a breakup with a girlfriend who dumped me. She probably was a smart one. And I began having a panic attack. I had no idea what the hell this was. You know, crossing a bridge, I thought I was going to go off the side of the bridge. And so I began reading about panic attacks, and I realized that that's what I was having. I don't think of myself as somebody who worries a lot. I tend to be like you, who prepared for the exam and try to get things done beforehand. You know, the defensive pessimism, and I have another technique which you can actually try in the studio. You just take your right hand. Okay. And you wave it up in the air, and you say, "So what?"
Exactly.
So what?
Actually, if you wave your hand, you'll feel better. So what? If my paw doesn't go well,
it's like batting it away. Yeah. It really is. Yeah, it's like sort of like tossing it away.
Or who cares? You find that like ordinary people who are, don't have PhDs or social work degrees or psychiatry degrees, ordinary people have the greatest mantras. Like, yes, an ordinary person. Well, how do you feel about the breakup? Well, I got to the point, and the person waves their hand, and they say, "So what? Who cares anymore?"
Yeah, it's
just
that's
a way of taking the catastrophe out of ordinary events. So what? But I don't think of myself as somebody who worries that much. I've gotten used to the fact that no matter what I do, there are going to be some people who just don't like me.
It's true.
That's a relief.
That's the acceptance part of it that you were talking about, I think, too.
It is.
There's
a great deal of freedom in indifference. Mm-hmm. A great deal of freedom in indifference. And if you can become indifferent to, well, if this goes well, fine, if it doesn't, so what? Or a person doesn't like me, what can I do? That's extremely helpful.
Yeah, and that's my whole thing about expectations. Like having reasonable expectations of events and people really mm-hmm. helps to keep that anxiety at bay, because it's like,
absolutely.
Expect nothing. God. Whatever you get is great.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I figure that my view of expectations for myself is that I want to lower my standards so much that if I fall down, it's a step up.
Well, all of your achievements. I have a question for you.
You're absolutely right. You're right about expectations. These people like, oh my God, I have to get 100%, or I have to look perfect, or the party I give has to go perfectly well, or everything I say has to be so interesting. And if you change your expectations to match the reality that just happened, you won't be disappointed.
That's so true.
Absolutely.
You expect that no matter what you do, you're going to disappoint people.
Yeah.
You're going to let them down. You're going to frustrate them.
Exactly.
You automatically just change your expectations. Oh, my expectation is what just happened.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I got into a time machine.
So true.
And as they say,
but you're absolutely right. Expectations are so much part of it. And the idea of taking it personally, like I have to make it happen.
Yeah.
That's a key part of worry. It's all up to me.
Right.
Yeah. One technique I use is the technique to imagine that you just, like you think, oh my God, what would this person think of me? That person think of me? No, just imagine you disappear for like 5 minutes. No one's thinking about you. You never existed. It's just the world out there. It's all almost like a very Zen type thing. It's like a Zen warrior who goes out to the battlefield and he's the only person standing there.
Yeah, sure.
It's
true.
Like it's a liberation.
It's a liberation to
get to that point.
Hey, we have an email that came in that's related to you and this topic. Would you be up for hearing it and giving some feedback?
Sure.
All right.
If it's from a cat, if it can a cat.
It is. Sounds like it's from a cat. No, it sounds like it's from a dog with separation anxiety. Here we go. Dear Dr. Deborah and therapist Kelly, I know you're having on the author of The Worry Cure today. Perfect timing for me. I have moments of calm, but more often than not, I just feel anxious. I think I'm just wired that way. What can I do in those moments? I don't want to take medicine. I'd rather learn the approaches myself. So go at it, Doc.
Well, I think one of the things that I think is so important about worry is that it tends to repeat itself over and over. People don't say, well, I worried for 1 minute. Mm-hmm. What they're doing is they're saying, I'm worried throughout the day and night. So one technique that's very helpful is to set aside worry time. So let's imagine you take whatever you're worried about throughout the day and night, and you write it down on a piece of paper, and you put it off to the 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you say, at 4 o'clock, I'll get around to looking at it. Now, some people say, I can't do it, but I haven't found anybody who's not able to do it. That you're able, if you set it aside to 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock comes around, and you find out, some of the time, I no longer care about that, or it's worked itself out, or you're still worried about it. Then what you think, use a technique about, is it productive or unproductive worry?
Yes.
Is this something that I can actually do something about? Like, can I call the hotel and confirm my reservation? Or is this something I can't do something about? Like, what will people think of me? And if it's the latter, something I can't do something about, then you put it in the acceptance category. I'm just going to accept it. Let's see what happens. And what we'll see what happens when it happens, and now let's focus on which could be, you know, petting a dog or petting a cat or, mm-hmm. you know, going for a walk or, you know, doing something interesting. So if you stay in the present moment and set aside the worry for, let's see what happens when it happens, then you free yourself from it. If you set aside the worry time, you liberate yourself for 23 hours and 59 minutes.
That's smart.
That's I like it. It's like a paradoxical intervention.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I'm writing this down. And then I have a question, too. Do these apply to phobias? So I have a very strong phobia of vomit. And I'm curious if the same sort of rules or there are different techniques that apply in that case.
And by the way, I have tried the desensitizing technique with Kelly coming in here and vomiting at the beginning of each show, but it
doesn't work. No. God, in fact, one time.
What are friends for?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, vomit is the fear of phobia. The fear of vomit is a phobia.
Yeah.
And what you should do is just immerse yourself in watching YouTube videos
of
vomit.
Wow.
I mean, I know it's disgusting, literally, figuratively.
Yes. I was thinking the desensitization.
But, you know, doing it until you really get so desensitized, it doesn't really have an effect on you.
Oh. Well, she had a live version of that with her kids.
Oh,
was it? Which
God.
One was chronic vomiting and diarrhea? Oh, my gosh.
All the time. Well, I think what happens to me, it's so interesting. It's like, it's when is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And then when it happens, it's like, all right, it happened. It's fine. It's over.
Right.
But it's like that moment before where you're like,
when
is it going to happen? Or am I going to get sick?
Right.
Who's going to get sick? But yeah, it's debilitating. It's absolutely horrifying.
But you had that classroom experience when you were, what, like 7 or 8 in the classroom where somebody was vomiting? In front of you?
Oh, that didn't
you
so much. My
that...
brother used to have migraines and throw up all the time, but I don't know why. I feel like it's gotten worse as I've gotten older, and I don't know why.
Well, probably because in your mind you build it up to be an imaginary event.
Yes.
And you probably are avoiding things, but, you know, really for a phobia like that,
mm-hmm.
Just immersing yourself in, you know, you can probably download YouTubes of vomiting. And just sit there and just watch it over. And I know it sounds disgusting, but just keep your eye on it and just, you know, repeat on watching vomiting. And you find after a while, I mean, you can get used to just about anything.
That's a really
one of the interesting things about disgust, like people have, you know, revulsions about food.
Mm-hmm.
The way of getting over a food revulsion is eat a lot of the food you don't like.
Yeah.
The more you eat it, the more you like it.
So interesting.
Or the less disgusting it is.
I cannot do it with liver. Speaking of throwing up, my mother used to intentionally make liver so the house would smell for the dog. And I would ask her, please, Mom, just tell me the day you're going to make it. I will be out on my bicycle all day long. I would come home and she wouldn't have told me and I would just throw up right there.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I can't handle
it. Wow.
You know, you so, and boy.
Yeah,
that's so
some phobias are not worth dealing with.
No.
That's really interesting. Wow.
So and then, of course, now my daughter, who is no longer a vegetarian, she had become a vegetarian for a while. Now she and her boyfriend were talking about making this turkey, you know, and they got the giblets and they were going to put that in the gravy. And I'm like, oh, no. This is my house. That is not going in anything that I'm going to smell or eat.
Oh, God.
But see, the two of you could work together on this. You could be eating the liver and vomiting, and your colleague could be watching you.
Exactly. It's perfect. We'll make our own YouTube
video. It's such a natural pairing. Right?
That is
perfect.
So funny.
Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly live on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly.
Vomiting.
Oh,
and see, loving
like,
it.
Even talking about this, I'm like, oh, this is like enough desensitization for one day. For me.
Okay.
Oh, that's so gross. Oh my god.
Oh my god.
So
yes.
Okay. So I have another question. As far as I'm sure people want to know too, do men and women worry equally?
Well, women are twice as likely to be diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. So women are twice as likely to be worriers as men are, probably because women have to deal with men. So, but I think, I mean, part of it may be genetic. Part of it may be that that females are either genetically predisposed or through socialization focused on attachment and empathy. So they're very concerned, and you have to tell a young mother, "Don't worry about your child; it's just pointless. You really, it's not going to go anywhere." There's just such a strong, instinctive tendency for that. But I think also women in our society are raised to believe that they're not going to be that competent in solving real problems, and then they're not going to be as effective, even though they tend to be in some cases even more effective than men. Like you take investment, mm-hmm. that women investors do better than men investors, because men have such great confidence that they think they can keep trading. And what happens is that they keep trading, yeah. incurring greater and greater costs and losses, whereas a woman is buying and holding and, you know, and making more money. So, there may be some of that. And also, one thing we know about worry is that people who empathize more are more likely to worry because they're more concerned with how people feel.
Yes, that's so me.
That explains it.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's so interesting. That makes a lot of sense.
But I would say that actually over the years, my ability to sort of contain my worrying and anxiety has really improved tremendously. I remember encountering this 75-year-old man who specialized in anxiety and went to an anxiety workshop, mm-hmm. and he comes running out on the stage. I mean, he was literally about 5 foot tall. He comes running out. He's 75 years old. He was a heart surgeon, and he's got a paper bag that he's holding, and he goes, "This is the boo." The boo, like, this is what scares you, this, like, puppet that, you know, talking to. And he said, the three things about anxiety. Take the question of what if, change it to what else. And when you answer the what else, if your worst nightmare is going to occur, you'll handle it. Because we're all equipped with fight, flight, or freeze. So there it is. He said, that's it. That's your formula to decrease worry. And it really worked for some reason. Maybe it was his delivery, but it had a powerful impact on me to think.
That's nice.
Because it all embedded in there was, okay, I don't have control over lots of things. Mm-hmm. And all of those good things that you're talking about, Dr. Leahy.
What I was going to say, too, spirituality has really helped me, too. And I think that has to do with your acceptance piece and just sort of realizing, like, you know, there's more out there. Like, I don't control this world, and just sort of like surrendering and let go and all of that has really helped me in the last 10 years. And so that's why I understand why people, you know, who are religious feel maybe, you know, even haven't they done studies with like the power of prayer and just sort of like releasing it can kind of help you let go of it and that kind of thing.
I don't know. I'll give you an example of what you're describing. I had a patient, many years ago who's Orthodox Jewish guy. Mm-hmm. Actually, he was Reformed. He was becoming one. And he went on a retreat, and there was a rabbi there. The rabbi was in a wheelchair, and the patient, we'll call him Bill, said to the rabbi, "You know, I'm really depressed. I worry a lot and all this." And the rabbi said, "You know, I'm not depressed. And look at me. I'm in a wheelchair." And Bill said, "You know, Rabbi, tell you the truth, I don't know if I'd be able to handle it." And the rabbi said, "Well, what if I said to you, I'll give you $10 million? How would you feel?" And Bill said, "Well, I feel pretty good. What if I said to you the next day I decided I can only give you $9 million? How would you feel?" And Bill said, "I'd still feel good." And Rabbi said, "Well, that's what God did for me." I think it was a beautiful expression of gratitude for what you do have as opposed to what you don't have. Mm-hmm. My patients years ago really educated me on this. He was a born-again Christian. Mm-hmm. And he had been really decadent before he changes his orientation. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, we're talking about worry, and he said, "You know what I realize is that when you have gratitude, you can't have worry." And if you think about one technique that I've used is the technique I call take it all away. So let's imagine that everything that you are, your body, your mind, your family, all your possessions, all your senses, all your memories have been taken away. And now you can ask for one thing back at a time. And God will only give you each thing back if you can convince God that you really appreciate it. And I've used this technique many, many times. And I find that people say, you forget about what they're worried about. I want my daughter back. I want my wife back. I want my eyesight back. What do you want to see? I want to see my daughter. I want to see my wife. You know, and they go through these everyday things with their tears in their eyes, completely moved. And I said, well, you can have all those things back. You actually have them all already, except you've been so concerned about this worry or this resentment that you haven't noticed what's actually in front of you.
That's so interesting. I like that a lot. What did you call it? The takeaway technique?
Yeah, take it all away.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Wow. You know, I've tried to use versions of that with my stepmom after my dad passed, you know, 4 years ago, actually just this last Sunday, December 27th, we had the gathering at our house and we sort of honored him. And she just so stuck in her grief, you know, she's just so stuck and almost like she would feel like she betrayed him if she allowed herself to be happy. And I'm like, but, you know, Dora, you just had all your grandchildren in town at the same time. You got to see all of these beautiful girls who you love so much. And your other set of grandkids, the boys are always around and near and dear. And but sadly, you know, I think also there's some people that are just so mired in a sense of guilt if they to release or let that happy or just feel like that's their death sentence themselves. So it's really sad, but I'm gonna try it that way. See if it
like that
work a little bit.
You know, I think one of the things that our culture tends to push on people is that we have to be happy all the time and everything has to go just right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people say, well, I don't want to suffer, you know. My view, I was giving a lecture in an emotion. And this professor came up after his wife had died and had been together 40 years. And he said, you know, it's been 8 months since she died. She had a long cancer battling it for years. And it was time for her to die. It was a good thing for her to die for her, but I can't get over it. And I said to him, I said, you know, I know you loved your wife and I know you still love your wife. And I'm going to tell you something you probably don't expect me to say. And that's that I hope you never get over it. I hope you're always able to remember your wife and feel sad about losing her, but I hope you're able to build a life large enough to contain the other memories and the other meanings that you have now. In other words, live a life worth suffering for, that your life can be large enough that it can contain that memory of suffering and not have to push it away or eliminate that. And I think that that's really a key thing, because all of us are going to lose people we love. We have to have a way of looking at it that it's worth it. Mm-hmm, it's worth having those people in our lives and losing them. So it's worth it. It's worth the suffering.
On that beautiful note, we are out of time. I looked at the clock. Oh, my gosh. We actually have to wrap up really quickly. Well, this went so fast. You're just an amazing guest. Such great information.
And so calming, really. You really are so calming. And so where can people find your books, or what do you want to promote? Anything that any last, you know, minute parting words?
You can go to our website, cognitivetherapynyc.com. That's cognitivetherapynyc.com. And the book that we've been talking about is The Worry Cure, which is available on Amazon or any bookstore. But it's great talking to you. And, you know, try to keep in mind that every day is a gift.
Oh, thank you.
So
that's
nice.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much. Yeah. We loved having you on.
All right. Wow.
Thank you.
Yeah. So next week, we have medium Anthony William, author of Secrets Behind Chronic and Mystery Illnesses and How to Finally Heal, which is
so cool.
Awesome. And also, Kelly, next week we start with our new sponsor.
Yes,
so we do want to give a little plug here now. So next week we have a new sponsor, and she is Kim Gold. We had her on our show a while back. She's the author of the business memoir Gold Standard, How to Rock the World and Run an Empire. And this book is called A Front Row Seat to a Huge Upheaval, not only in her own life, but in American business as it comes to grips with the kind of woman who is here to change the game.
So
very
cool.
Exciting. Okay, so welcome aboard, Kim.
Yes.
And of course, if you want to check more out about Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly, I'm getting it right, please go to our new website, docandtherapist.com.
Thank you so much, and look for us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Bye-bye.
Have a great one.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.